Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in a moment, why isn't the Obama administration reining in Wall Street rating agencies? But first, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, who'd been missing for almost 7 days, surfaced at the Atlanta, Georgia airport today and told a reporter he'd been in Argentina. Yesterday, Sanford's office announced the Republican governor had been hiking the Appalachian Trail. Even his wife didn't know where he was, and his lieutenant governor publicly complained about not hearing from him. Sanford's raised eyebrows before, for instance, when he brought piglets to the state house to fight pork barrel spending, but this was different. Gina Smith of South Carolina's The State newspaper was the reporter who greeted him at the airport this morning. Gina, you had a tip. He was in Buenos Aires, so you went to the nearest airport, but still, were you surprised to see him?
I was completely shocked. Again, it was just a hunch. I was just standing there with all of these other people who are waiting for, you know, family and friends to get off the plane and come into the airport. And all of a sudden, there was the governor. I was like, oh, my gosh. I was really surprised. Actually, had pretty much given up because, you know, it seemed like the crowd had all come into the airport. And I'm thinking, well, he's not in the plane. I was about to pack it up, and boom, there he was.
Was Governor Sanford surprised to see you?
Yeah, he seemed a bit taken aback to see me. I mean, he didn't try to run away or anything, but, you know, he obviously was not expecting to be greeted by any media, and I was the only media person there. And I just said, Governor, hey, you know, we all thought you were hiking the Appalachian Trail. What's been going on? And he sort of looked at me for a moment and said, well, how about we go sit down and have a talk. So he sat down with me for about 5 or 6 minutes and talked about how he does love to hike the Appalachian Trail. It's something he's been doing since he was a high school student. And ever since those early days, he periodically likes to take what he calls sort of these adventure trips just to get, as he put it, outside the bubble, which is public life.
But were either his wife or law enforcement worried?
You know, you hit it right on the head there. His wife said that she wasn't worried. Law enforcement didn't seem overly worried. Most of the worries seemed to come from fellow lawmakers who, a lot of them, quite frankly, disagree with Sanford on a lot of different topics.
Well, we remind ourselves that this was the governor who was against President Obama's stimulus package, so dead set against it that he tried to block the $700 million that was to come to South Carolina. He lost that battle, and he had said that he needed a break from this last legislative session where there were all those fights. But weren't some in his own party saying, we need to know what's going on here, we need to have some communication?
Absolutely. There's been concerns, particularly from one Lexington County Republican, Senator Jakey Knotts, who is a political foe of Governor Sanford, who said, yeah, he wanted to know who was running the executive branch, and he felt that it was inappropriate for the governor to go missing for such a long period of time with limited contact with the staff. Now, that gets into the question, did the staff really know where he was, or did they really think he was hiking the Appalachian Trail? I don't know. When I asked the governor that, I said, you know, Governor, as recently as yesterday, your staff was telling everyone that you're hiking the Appalachian Trail. Why would your staff think that when you're really in Buenos Aires? And he said, well, you know, I talked to my chief of staff yesterday, but he says that his chief of staff didn't ask him where he was, and the governor did not volunteer that information.
Well, there have been a litany of gubernatorial missteps recently. Democrats Rob Blagojevich in Illinois, Elliot Spitzer in New York. This doesn't rise to that, at least from what we see. But what is your sense of whether or not this is going to blow over? Mark Sanford is considered presidential material by some Republicans, and yet he's also considered to be his own man.
Mark Sanford has definitely always marched to his own drum, and there are definitely factions of the Republican Party who absolutely adore him and would love to see him run as president in 2012. But certainly there are some other Republicans who really disagree with him, think that he is sort of an ideologue that gets going on soapboxes like government restructuring and is just unwilling to compromise, sort of an all-or-nothing kind of attitude. So I really don't know if this will blow over or not. I think there's more to the story that will eventually come out.
That's Gina Smith, reporter for South Carolina's The State newspaper in Atlanta, where she discovered the governor returning from Buenos Aires this morning. Gina, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
President Obama's plan to increase oversight of Wall Street has been called sweeping and historic, even by some bankers who chafe at the thought of more government regulations. But it's also come under fire from liberal critics like former IMF economist Simon Johnson, who says the overhaul plan simply doesn't go far enough. And then there's business writers like Joe Nocera of The New York Times, who called it regulation on the margins, not even close to what Roosevelt accomplished during the Great Depression, he writes. Well, today we want to dissect a slice of the plan that's been particularly criticized. Credit ratings agencies such as Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch Ratings, the top three, that stamped gold seals of approval on the toxic subprime securities that were at the heart of the global economic meltdown. Gretchen Morgenson is business reporter for The New York Times, and thankfully she'll be our guide today. Welcome back, Gretchen.
I'm happy to be here.
We want you to tiptoe us through this part of the economy, but first, your initial thoughts on how the Obama administration approached these agencies in the plan.
Well, it was with almost a kid glove approach, I would say, Robin, and that is unfortunate because here we have an opportunity for some real change. You know, the unfortunate aspect is there really is no alternative at the moment. It really has been since the 70s that these rating agencies have had the imprimatur of the government really backing them, and the investor community really is almost forced to buy ratings or to buy securities that have ratings. And so it's really a duopoly that's really got the government sort of backing it. And it has led to a not surprising situation where their work has really been very questionable and central to the collapse.
Well, let's explain how it works. You say a duopoly. It also sounds like a tortured tango. Tell us, first of all, and it's credit agencies 101, what do they do?
What these companies do is they purport to look at a company's and any issuer of debt, to look at that issuer, look at the financial soundness of the issue, how the issue is structured. If it's a pretty straight corporate bond, then they would look at the obligations that that company has to repay debt over time, and they would give it a rating. And that rating is sort of based upon the ability of that company to repay the bond over time.
How much cash they have on hand, how good the company looks?
Exactly. Their financial soundness, their financial standing.
And it could be mortgages too?
Well, you see, that is where they got into trouble. These companies were, you know, for decades able to look at corporate issues and say, you know, with a fairly good record, you know, this company will be able to pay this bond back or this company won't. And so for years it was, they were an accepted part of the process for any debt issuer. But in the mortgage mania that we've just lived through and the ensuing bust, what happened was these securities were far more complex than a straight corporate bond. They were not only pools of mortgages, thousands of mortgages in a pool. They were also something called collateralized debt obligations, which were pools of pools.
Right.
So it was really, you know, had a multiplier effect of complexity. And what it meant was that these, you know, people who were used to looking at, say, one company's financial strength were now supposed to be looking at thousands of loans and trying to assess the probability of those loans paying off over time.
Well, Gretchen,
they just fell down on the job.
Right. And we also understand that another part of this story is that the relationship between the rating agencies and the companies whose bonds or now mortgages that they rated changed. Take us back historically. How have rating agencies interacted with investment firms and banks?
Well, early on, these agencies were truly independent, meaning that they did not accept payment from the issuer, from the entity whose bonds they were rating. They accepted payment from the people who purchased the research, and that is a pretty clean formula. It is not a conflicted business model. Well, they changed that, and as soon were they began asking the issuers to pay, and so now we have this model where the people who are rating the bonds or the mortgages are being paid by the people issuing that debt. And so you have a built-in conflict of interest that really does seem to impair the independence of the organizations.
Well, let me compare some thoughts on that here. You have a quote from a 1957 interview with a Moody's vice president who said, "We obviously cannot ask payment for rating a bond. To do so would attach a price to the process, and we could not accept the charge, escape the charge, rather, which would undoubtedly come that our ratings are for sale." That's in 1957. And now, as you say, they are paid for rating bonds and things. And your colleague Eric Dash at the New York Times recently wrote, "Isn't this as if Hollywood studios paid movie critics to review their would-be blockbusters?" Was there a moment in time when that changed? I mean, how did it go from "we are not going to accept payment for the investment firms to rate their bonds. We instead will make our money by selling our ratings to banks and things who want to know how much things are worth," to "we will be paid by firms to rate their financial instruments"?
I think that the only way this was allowed to change and not really sort of have investors get up in arms over it was because these companies had been sort of staid and, respectable, certainly, almost like utility companies. They were not flashy. They were not aggressive. And so over the years, they had built up a reputation of soundness and of conservativeness. And so it was that when they did make the model change, it was not a frightening thing. It didn't make people feel that they were suddenly going to be vulnerable to a new kind of operation where profit was the key and the driver, and that would bring the conflicts into, the problem zone. Well, what happened was you did then have a situation where Moody's went public. It had its own stock that was issued. It had been a unit of another company for many years.
This was in 2000 when Moody's went public?
Yes, yeah. When Moody's went public, then you had a stock that could be given, options that could be assigned to executives and members of these rating committees, and the profit motive became far more compelling. And that is what many, many Moody's ex-employees told me when I was interviewing them for my articles that I've written over this. And that was a sea change that really occurred.
Well, you say you spoke with a former Moody's executive who told you by the 1990s, the watchdog got muzzled and gelded. It was told to turn into a lapdog. You've got stockholders who want more profits. You've got people who are being pressured to give high ratings. This is Gretchen Morgenson, business reporter for the New York Times. We're talking about credit rating agencies. We're going to take a minute break, Gretchen. When we come back, what did they know, when did they know it, about the toxic stocks that they were giving high ratings to? Also, later today, we'll have books for tweens for the summer. Don't forget that. But back in a minute with more from Gretchen Morgenson and credit rating agencies Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the role credit ratings agencies played in the economic collapse with Gretchen Morgenson, business reporter for The New York Times. She's taken us through a timeline of credit ratings agencies as respected, independent, almost like utilities, and then a time where in 2000, Moody's, one of the biggest agencies, went public. Now you have stockholders, pressure to rate things that may not be as valuable because there's a demand for more income for companies like Moody's. But Gretchen, we want to rush to point out that there are different divisions to these rating companies. Analysts like Mark Zandi, for instance, are part of Moody's Economic.com. That's not the arm that we're talking about that rates securities. And at one point, the divisions that did the ratings structured finance in Moody's case. We read accounted for 53% of Moody's revenue, and that meant that they were making more than Exxon and Microsoft made. So there's this drive now on the part of these rating agencies to make money.
Exactly. And, you know, these financial instruments that were filled with mortgages or that were pools of pools, as we talked about earlier, were very complex. And so Moody's and S&P and Fitch could charge far more to rate one of those entities and one of those issues than they would for a plain vanilla corporate credit from, say, IBM or General Electric. So it became this sort of frenzy to do these deals. And Wall Street, of course, was putting out these securities like there was no tomorrow, trying to meet the insatiable demand from investors. And, you know, that is what was kept the entire machine spinning.
But then we come to what did they know and when did they know it? You wrote a year ago about a moment in 2005 when the country's largest mortgage lender, this was Countrywide Financial, didn't like a rating that it received for a pool of mortgage securities. And they told Moody's they didn't like it, and overnight Moody's changed that rating, upgraded it, without any new information coming in. And you write that happened several times.
This is a one of the stories that has come out, and you know, if I could talk to more former employees who would be willing to do so, I'm sure we'd hear about more conversations about this kind of thing from all of the rating agencies. The companies that were issuing these securities were very powerful, of course, and they could take away the income stream that these rating these securities had for the rating agencies by just saying, okay, if you're not going to give me the rating that I want, then, you know, I'll take it somewhere else and they will rate it how I'd like it. There was a feeling of a race here to the bottom because they were, you know, there were three of them that were all very competitive and the profit potential was so enormous that, you know, the idea of actually saying no was increasingly difficult. Now, in congressional testimony last year, there were some emails that were, uncovered by the investigators, and it had people in these rating agencies being honest amongst themselves that these were not well-rated, that they were not able to really analyze the mortgages inside the pools, and that even cows would rate these securities. That was one of the emails
right.
that I remember that was just stunning to us.
Well, those are the emails from the rating agencies, but we also had the emails from Countrywide in which the company's now indicted former CEO referred to his company's subprime loan products as toxic and poison. So people knew.
He's not indicted. He was just charged with insider trading in a civil case, just so you know.
Oh, good. Don't we get that right? Yep.
Yeah, no, people knew. There's no doubt that people had doubts about these securities, but, boy, the profits were so enormous, gigantic. As you said, Moody's was a company that was more profitable than practically any other company in the S&P 500. So that's an extremely compelling income stream, believe me.
So, Gretchen Morgenson, the question of the hour, why in the president's new plan and overhaul the economy, why not take ratings agencies back to the day when they received their income from selling their ratings to banks and other investors as opposed to being paid by companies to rate things? Why not go back to the old system since it has proven such a slippery slope?
I really don't know the answer. I mean, my reading of that document, the 88-page Treasury proposal, was very short shrift was given to the rating agencies. And that's a disappointment because we really all have to conclude that they were central to this problem. Investors are extremely annoyed, irate, with the fact that they were given assigned these high ratings and only to see enormous defaults and delinquencies and problems. The losses are, you know, really uncountable at this moment. So why we are letting this business model, which has been shown to be very flawed, why we're letting that stand is really beyond me.
Well, some critics feel they have the answer. The Center for Responsive Politics has reported that 10 firms that issue credit ratings spent $370,000 on lobbying during the first 3 months of 2009, an increase of 42% over the same period last year. The implication being this soft treatment was in some ways bought.
Well, unfortunately, that is the business model that we have to work with from our legislative standpoint. I think that the problem here, Robin, is that the government's imprimatur on these rating agencies, the fact that you have to be a government-approved rating agency, is really key to the problem. If this were a market that were competitive, where, you know, really good analysts could come in, start up a new company, provide due diligence, do the work and prove with their track record that they were able to spot problems well ahead of the defaults, then you would have competition, and the people who, Moody's, S&P, those companies that did not perform well would be punished by a loss of revenue. But we just don't have that kind of model here, and that's continuing to be the problem.
Gretchen Morgenson, business reporter for the New York Times, helping us walk through the sometimes minefield of credit ratings agencies and the role they played in the economic collapse. Gretchen, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And it's a story we'll continue to follow. By the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, is texting affecting the way kids develop? One social scientist says texting is interfering with their sleep, making them more anxious, and also damaging their thumbs. That's tomorrow. But we have much more ahead, including the latest news here and now. A handful of countries engage in whale hunting, and they're defending themselves at the International Whaling Commission meeting this week. Opponents of whale hunting released a study at the meeting that says whaling countries would be better off economically if they switched from whale hunting to whale watching. Richard Black is the BBC's environment correspondent. He joins us from the IWC meeting on the Portuguese island of Madeira. And Richard, first of all, what kind of whale hunting is there, and what countries hunt whales?
Norway and Iceland hunt commercially, and they're allowed to do that because the 1982 moratorium, which banned commercial hunting worldwide, countries were allowed to object to that, and Iceland and Norway did, and that's why they are allowed to hunt commercially now. Japan hunts large quantities of whales under regulations designed to allow hunting for scientific research. And then you've got a number of other countries, including the US, where groups of indigenous people who are deemed to have a nutritional and cultural need hunt whale meat. So, for example, in the US, you've got the Inupiat groups in Alaska who are allowed to take a certain number of bowhead whales each year, as they have done for certainly centuries.
And you mentioned Japan hunting for scientific purposes. Don't whale hunting foes and critics feel that that's sometimes a cover for commercial hunting?
Yes, this is one of the criticisms which is most frequently lodged against Japan. The meat is processed and sold, and this is another criticism that environmental groups make. They say it's just commercial whaling in disguise. On the other hand, the convention that regulates whaling does say proceeds from scientific hunts should be processed wherever practicable, and Japan says that's simply what it's doing.
Tell us about this study that was released this week by the International Fund for Animal Welfare. They say that whale watching would be better for countries than whale hunting.
The International Fund for Animal Welfare commissioned an Australian group of economists to look at this, and basically that group of economists contacted whale watching operators, tourist boards in I think it was 119 countries, and they came up with a value for the whale watching industry of $2.1 billion per year. Now, certainly, if you put that against the economics of whale hunting, it dwarfs any profits or any losses that might be incurred from whale hunting. But the counter comment, certainly from Iceland and Norway, is that the two things are compatible. If you talk to Norwegians, for example, they will talk about tourists going there. They'll go out, they'll watch some whales, they'll come back, have a whale barbecue on the beach. They don't see the contradiction. IFOR does.
Well, and where do you see this going?
You can't whale watch everywhere in the world. Most of the prime locations, I think, have been very developed. I've never been whale watching on Cape Cod myself, but people who have say it's absolutely fantastic.
You ought to try it. It's just wonderful.
No, I certainly would love to. And around here in Madeira, actually, this is becoming a venue for it. Madeira, there was whale hunting here until about 30 years ago when the whale hunters switched to becoming whale watchers when the global moratorium came in. Quite an interesting case, actually. They used to do the old style Yankee whaling, you know, with handheld harpoons and small boats and so on. But now if you go down to the harbour here, you'll see five or six companies all offering whale watching cruises. I haven't been out myself, but several other people at the conference have, and they tell me it's very good.
So, especially since there's an example right there in Madeira, is there a chance that at least some of the numbers of whales killed every year might turn into whales watched?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I mean, Iceland is in really severe financial straits. That may mean, it's likely to mean, that it applies to join the European Union. A number of European Union countries are saying, no way if you continue whaling. Norway, really, it's commercial pressures. If people are finding it profitable to hunt whales, I think they will. It's a pretty straight up and down industry. Japan is different. Japanese whaling is very, very political. So there's no real force, I think, that could compel Japan to stop whaling. And that's why some environment groups over the last couple of years have encouraged anti-whaling countries to sit down with Japan and see whether they can thrash out some kind of compromise which could reduce the total number of whales killed each year.
Richard Black, the BBC's environment correspondent, speaking to us from Madeira at the International Whaling Commission meeting. Richard, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, just ahead, the 56-year-old white woman beats the 33-year-old black woman to lead Now. What does that mean for the future of the women's organization? That's in 30 seconds, here and now. America's largest feminist group, the National Organization for Women, has a new president, 56-year-old Terry O'Neill. O'Neill is an attorney. She serves on Now's national board, and she replaces Kim Gandy, who reached her term limit at 8 years in the post. Terry O'Neill won a close election, narrowly defeating 33-year-old Latifa Lyles, who would have been the group's first African-American president, not to mention the youngest president. Terry O'Neill joins us on the phone from her home in Maryland to tell us what she thinks her victory means. Terry, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, Robin.
But as we said, close vote, just 8 votes separated you from 33-year-old Latifa Lyles. What do you take from that?
What I take from that is both teams were strong. I believe the reason I won is because of my pledge to get Now into the grassroots in a very aggressive way and to mount a very aggressive membership recruitment program.
Well, does this win, though, also further expose a fissure people have been talking about, a potential fissure, between the grassroots organizations that you talk about, women across America meeting in kitchens and in neighborhoods to take on issues, and the new sort of online feminists? Here are some quotes. I'm sure you've seen them. Mm-hmm. This is from the 30-year-old founder of the blog Feministing.com. Mm-hmm. She says she never paid attention to Now till Latifa Lyles ran. She says, when you think of Now, you think of white middle-class feminists, 70s feminism, and she wants more youth-led groups doing more cutting-edge work. And she says she represents online feminists. Is there something you have to do to pull those people aboard?
Well, you know, the president runs with a team of vice presidential candidates. On my team are 2 29-year-old women and a woman who's much closer to my age. So different skill sets, different life experience, young women and baby boomer women. I am very proud of my team.
Well, I did want to ask you about the other aspect of a potential divide, which is color. As we mentioned, Latifa Lyles, 33-year-old, but also a black woman. And as you well know, in the history of the women's movement, there were some splits. Some black women in the late 60s, 70s felt left out. They said they cared more about economic issues, and they felt Now became a movement for white working women fighting for social issues like abortion rights. Other minority women felt that more important than a fight for equal gender rights was a fight for class or race equality. So you might have this team, but you're the public face of Now. Do you worry that you underscore that old fear, or, you know, do you plan on addressing it?
I was asked even before the election about the age and race differences. And, you know, I think it's really the most superficial aspect of the election. The membership, the people who were in Indianapolis talking to the candidates, asking questions, sizing us up, deciding who they wanted to lead the organization for the next 4 years, were interested in much more of the meaty issues. Should we be committed to being a membership organization, what I think of as the outsider strategy? Or should we be more committed to more of an insider strategy, lobbying and nurturing relationships with elected officials? It turned out that my appeal, which was to grassroots organizing, more of the outsider strategy, was the one that won the day. And I think that's what people were mostly concerned with.
As opposed to spending more time on Capitol Hill, perhaps in the White House, with policymakers.
Sure. And you have to do both. I don't want to suggest that somehow it's not good for feminist activists to be talking to elected officials. Of course it is. Our core issues are achieving reproductive rights, ending racism, achieving lesbian rights, ending violence against women, getting women into the Constitution, some form of an equal rights amendment, and achieving economic justice for women. Those are our six core issues.
Well, let's take a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
The Equal Rights Amendment.
Sure.
It's decades, and it's not been enacted. Some would say its time has passed, that they look around, they scan the landscape, and they say, look at all the women in the White House at high levels working for the new president. That's just one example. Playing devil's advocate, they say there's no need for it.
I know. I've heard that so many times over the years. You have all the equality you really need. Why do you want, you know, full equality? Aren't you satisfied with what you have? And the answer is no, we're not satisfied.
What aren't you satisfied with?
We're 50% of the population, and only 16% of Congress are women. We are 50% of the population, and yet women account for only 16% of the governorships. Women today, on average, earn 78 cents to the dollar earned by a white male. And here's where the insider-outsider strategy, I think, becomes important. You work on legislative issues, which is very important, legislation like the Lilly Ledbetter Act.
This is the first act signed by President Obama that overturned a ruling that workers couldn't sue for equal pay after a certain time limit. There had been a time limit put on it.
Right, but it's not near enough. That act alone is not going to close the wage gap. What I'm proposing is a national action campaign that will demand a zeroing out of the wage gap.
It's so much more complicated, though, than simply forcing employers to pay the same amount of money to men and women. As you well know, economists will remind us women still have to take off much more time for childcare, so they get out of the promotion loop and they don't get to the higher paying jobs. And that's part of why the median average salary is lower.
Did you know that the best marker of whether a woman will live in poverty in her old age, the one thing, is if she was a mom? Being a mother is the one factor that correlates strongly with living in poverty in old age. It's an absolutely astonishing statistic.
It is, and considering that a mother would have children who you'd think would support her.
Yeah, well, apparently we don't have policies in this country that support caregivers. And remember that caregiving is largely unpaid. It is largely done by women. As a result, women tend to cluster in part-time work that doesn't have benefits and doesn't have a pension.
Quick thought on abortion. Democratic leaders have tried to find common ground with anti-abortion forces. Do you feel the need to reach out to, say, the nurse we once met who said that her religious beliefs prevented her from giving patients information about abortion?
Well, achieving reproductive rights and justice is a core issue for now. We'll never back off from that. That seems to me to be simply a foundational aspect of human rights norms.
You're saying, well, she shouldn't be a nurse?
Of course it's her right to refuse to provide information. It's not her right to be a nurse.
Well, I want to touch on one last thing, and you mentioned in your list of the mission of NOW, and that had to do with domestic abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you come by firsthand.
Yes.
I understand you were abused by your first husband?
Yes, that's correct.
25 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious. Here you are, the president of NOW.
Yeah.
Could you see that arc from back there?
No, absolutely not. It was, I was 22, 23 years old. My coworker, I showed up at work, and I really had severe bruises and was quite traumatized. And she stood by my desk and said, "You must call your parents." And I said, "I can't. They think that my husband is a loser. They think I'm an idiot for marrying him. I'm too embarrassed. I'm too humiliated." And Karen said, "I'm standing here until you call your parents, and I will not move." And so I picked up the phone and called my dad, and he said,
come to our apartment, you can stay here. Mm-hmm. And it's the way it happened for me, and I really was extraordinarily lucky.
That moment that you describe with your coworker, it seems to me, was a mini national organization of women. It was and now of two.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it was exactly what I needed at the time.
Terry O'Neill, she will officially take over as the new president of the National Organization for Women on July 21st. Best to you.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you so much.
Well, we'd love to hear what you think about this or any story. Go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email, or just leave a comment right there on the homepage. Back with summer reading for the Miley Cyrus set in 1 minute, Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Kids between 9 and 12 years old used to be just kids, but today they're tweens and a lucrative marketing demographic worth $43 billion a year. Here's what they listen to. That there is tween royalty, Miley Cyrus, a.k.a. Hannah Montana, helping the Jonas Brothers kick off their new tour, singing Before the Storm at the Dallas Cowboy Stadium this past weekend. And here's what tweens are watching.
I know what you are. Your skin is pale white and ice cold. You don't go out into the sunlight.
Say it out loud. Say it.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
No.
That's Twilight, the teen vampire movie. But what are tweens reading? Today and tomorrow, we want to take a look at tween titles, starting today with young tweens. Sherry Eskin is the children's librarian at the Honan Alston branch of the Boston Public Library. Sherry, welcome back. And what's the difference between books for teenagers and books for tweens?
Teens are looking for not just coming of age and not just I like the guy down the street, but I like the guy down the street, I hate my parents, and I cut myself at night.
Well, not on occasion. they're working through, maybe they may not have health issues like cutting, but they're exploring them through their books.
Teens are dealing with a lot of stuff. Teen novels have become very problemy and issuey and angsty, and so the traditional coming-of-age novel has shifted down towards tweens.
Which is the age group we're going to talk about today. So when you say coming-of-age and tweens, what are their topics?
Tweens are dealing with, they're not quite dealing with romance, although some of them are getting there, but the biggest topic for tweens are their friends. And something that happens to tweens all the time is growing out of their friends. Tweens also have parent issues. They're just getting to the point where they hate their parents. They're not quite getting there, but they're sort of realizing, you know, my mom won't let me do this, and I really don't like that. Before, younger kids love their parents, no question. And also, tweens are dealing with school. That's a big issue.
So we understand there may be a lot of evil adults or orphans, which, you know, they might be wishing they are, and that way the kids can do that. So things, issues like that?
Yeah, there's definitely a popular trope in tween books that you see either an absent adult. So orphans, adults don't exist at all. Or you see an adult that's something to be dealt with, so a parent that a tween is having problems with.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at some of the tween books that you recommend. We'll start off with Allie Finkel's Rules for Girls by Meg Cabot. In this book, Allie Finkel is moving to a new house. She's not happy. And we enlisted the fifth graders at Franklin Elementary School in West Newton, outside of Boston, to help us with some of the readings. Here's Callie Dias.
Our new house looked so old that it was falling apart practically. It looked like all those houses on those TV shows my mom likes to watch. TV shows called things such as Please Come Fix Up My House and My House is Really Old. Won't someone fix it, please?
Kelly Dias reading from Meg Cabot's Allie Finkel's Rules for Girls as Allie Finkel moves to a new house. It's a reminder that tween books probably have a lot of pop culture in them.
Absolutely. Well, actually, Meg Cabot does a good job of, those aren't real TV show names, so that's good that it's not a real thing. But the great thing about Allie is that she lists her rules of her behavior, so every chapter is a new rule. So Allie is actually figuring out what her next step is. She's only 9, but every chapter is a new thing where she comes up with a new rule for herself, how to deal with something new that has popped up in her life, whether it's moving or dealing with a friend or dealing with her parents or she really wants a kitten. She's figuring out this stuff as she goes along.
Here's rule number 5. You can't let your family move into a haunted house.
Well, she's worried that this house is haunted.
Sure. Those are her rules. Allie Finkel's Rules for Girls. Let's move to younger tween boys, which would include my 9-year-old nephew, Josh. Josh, look, it's our favorite book, Diary of a Wimpy Kid by Jeff Kinney. Sherry, just briefly, we love this book. Why do so many kids love these the series of books?
I think Diary of a Wimpy Kid is, it's genre busting. I mean, it's a comic book and it's a book at the same time. It's so great. There's been nothing like this. It started off on the web and kids followed it into book form. And what makes it so funny is that everything seems so true. You know, when he has to be a tree in the Wizard of Oz play and one of the trees trips over the kid that plays the shrub. I mean, that really happens. That stuff is really is having it's hysterical.
Well, it's his diary, The Wimpy Kid. Here's a reading by Tonino Sarandria.
After a while, we realized the teenagers were going to wait us out, so we decided we were just going to have to spend the night at Grandma's. That's when we started getting cocky and making monkey noises at the teenagers and whatnot.
Tonino, great reading from Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And Sherry, what I love about this series by Jeff Kinney is that there's also a book you can get where kids can write their own diary.
Yeah, it's a do-it-yourself book. And because the art is very simple, line drawings, you can do it all yourself.
Diary of a Wimpy Kid. For young tweens, let's move to 11-year-olds. A book for boys or girls is, the name of this book is Secret, and in fact, in it, the whole first chapter is actually crossed out. Here's a reading from Vincent Ruisi.
I'm sorry I couldn't let you read chapter one. That was where you would have learned the names of the characters in the story, and you also would have learned where it takes place, and when. You would have learned all the things you usually learn at the beginning of a book. Unfortunately, I can't tell you any of those things. Yes, the story is about a secret, but it's also a secret story. I shouldn't even be telling you that I shouldn't be telling you the story. That's how much of a secret it is.
Sherry Eskin, again, the book is, if you haven't got it, the name of this book is Secret. Why do kids like this book?
Well, it's sort of in that Lemony Snicket vein. It has that insistent narrator that just never shuts up, keeps throwing himself into the story all the time, which is hysterical. But also, the you do find out the two main characters, they're a boy and the girl. The only adults in this are sort of these evil adults that they have to conquer. They infiltrate a place that the adults are trying. They have an evil quest for immortality, and they save one of their schoolmates. What's also nice about this book is that there are things that you can solve. There are puzzles in it and anagrams and codes, a little bit of history of Mussolini, you know, just good stuff for kids.
Okay. Oh, and you say it's sort of in that way like the Da Vinci Code for kids.
It is like the Da Vinci Code for kids. There's so much fun stuff to solve, and it's great. I mean, you just learn so much. I learned what synesthesia was, which I did not know before that.
Synesthesia, we just did a story on it. That's where you see colors.
Yeah, when your senses blend, and the people in this book, the evil adults, think that children with synesthesia have the secret to immortality.
Huh.
And so they get into their brains.
Well, thank you, Sherry.
Thank you.
That's Sherry Eskin, the children's librarian at the Honan Alston branch of the Boston Public Library, with her picks for books for younger tweens. Tomorrow she'll be back with some good reads for kids closer to teenhood. We'll have all the books at our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.